Well, hello everybody. I think it's not too loud from the door back there, but if it gets, we can close that door later. Keep an eye on that. But welcome everybody to Veterinary Public Health Special Interest Group sessions. We don't expect most of y'all to be veterinarians, and we appreciate that because we're leaning toward, we do espouse a One Health mission for our group. So it's love. That's why we're doing this special session today on the human animal relationship. I was approached by Haley, who's going to be one of our speakers, as an idea for this session, and it sort of builds on one that we had a couple years ago in San Francisco. So please welcome our first speaker here. Is Dr. Christine Goodall. I'm going to have to read a little bit on this. These bios are so huge. She's a senior clinical lecturer and honorary consultant oral surgeon at the University of Glasgow and founder and director of the Scottish charity Medics Against Violence. Her research centers around alcohol and violence. Y'all do speak Georgian, right? Okay, I didn't bring a translator, so... And in particular, youth violence and domestic abuse. So please welcome her to...
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I hope you understand Scottish as well, because I only have the one accent. So I'm going to be talking today about Making the Link and a programme that we've been doing training veterinary professionals to recognise and respond to domestic abuse in both humans and in animals. And just to start with, I have no relationships to disclose, aside from the fact that I'm not a vet. So you'll have to excuse me if I fall down a little bit on the animal side of things. I do have vets as co-authors on this. Just to let you know who Medics Against Violence are, because I'll be talking a bit about the work we do. We're a Scottish charity organisation. We were set up in 2008. And we're all healthcare professionals who've seen the results of violence in our daily jobs. We're very fortunate we have Scottish Government funding, and we work in partnership with a number of other organisations, including the ones that we've done this project with, and also organisations such as the World Health Organisation. And we're really about one thing, about preventing violence in all its forms, serious injury and death, of which we've all seen in our jobs far too much. And we do this in the main via education and awareness raising campaigns. And we very much take a public health approach to violence. So that's what we are. We've developed and we provide domestic abuse training to a number of different professional groups. And our training is delivered in partnership with the Scottish Violence Reduction Unit, who are a branch of the Scottish Police, who are wholly devoted to violence prevention. They don't do any arresting or locking up. They just devote their time to violence prevention. And our programme that we use and educate people in is based on one developed by Dr. Barbara Gerbert, who's from the University of California, San Francisco. She is, in fact, a dentist, as I am, and she developed this programme for use with dentists, and we've adapted it for other groups with her permission. And it's called AVDR. So our aim in providing domestic abuse training is to raise awareness, to increase knowledge, to increase confidence in approaching victims, to increase, therefore, the likelihood that professionals will take action and try and reach out to victims, both animal and human in this case, and also to expose more victims to opportunities to seek help, because domestic abuse is a very difficult thing for people to talk about. That's true of health professionals as well as the general public, and we hope by a spattergun approach to getting lots of people trained in how to approach it, we will allow victims to access help more easily. This is the definition of domestic abuse that we use in Scotland. It's a health definition of domestic abuse as opposed to a police or justice definition. But it encompasses violence in all its forms in terms of physical assault, sexual assault, and also psychological assault on the person. So domestic abuse involves an awful lot of behaviours, and they talk at home about coercive control and how that actually is one of the main elements of domestic abuse, and that is one of the ways that animals tend to become caught up in the whole cycle of abuse. Is through coercive control. So the range of domestic abuse is right from emotional, psychological, physical, sexual, but also things like financial abuse, where people are have money and means to escape withheld from them. So a big range of controlling behaviours. We know that in Scotland, 1 in 4 women will experience domestic abuse at some point in their lives. There were nearly 60,000 cases reported to the police in 2013-14. That will be undoubtedly the tip of the iceberg, because most people do not report this to the police. But we know that the level of repeat victimisation is very high. We also know it will take up to 35 instances of abuse to occur before somebody will think about talking about it, or indeed about seeking help from anybody for it. It can involve very serious sexual crimes like rape and sexual assault. And the cost of dealing with this amounts to 3% of our entire NHS budget in Scotland. The NHS is our health system. And that is a huge amount of money. If you think that we weren't having to spend that on domestic abuse, what other things we could do, what other things we could provide people with, it would actually be quite an enormous amount. Everybody working in health has seen victims. That goes without saying. We just don't always know what to do about it. And so what we try to do is give people the tools to try and deal with it in a very simple and straightforward way that they're comfortable with. We also know that it takes 6 to 7 attempts for somebody to leave a domestically violent situation before they will be successful in doing so. And we also know that if people are approached or asked about it, sometimes there is resistance or denial. But even the act of somebody who they consider to be a respected figure or somebody in authority asking about it will actually eventually make them think about it, and sometimes people then do take action. In terms of worldwide, domestic abuse is one of the leading causes of morbidity for women aged 19 to 44. And around the world, that is greater than the morbidity caused from things like motor vehicle accidents, which are a huge cause of injury worldwide. We know that in England and Wales, 2 women a week will die at the hands of their abuser. That children are often caught up in that as well. And sometimes when you see stories in the press about fathers having killed their children, that's often part of a domestic abuse situation where the woman has maybe left with the children, and this is the father's way of taking revenge. We also know that domestic abuse often starts around the time that people become pregnant. That's a very common time for abuse to start, particularly physical abuse. And there are lots of statistics about pregnant women having big issues with that. Health consequences for women, there are loads. A lot of them are psychological, but some of them are also physical. And we know that domestic abuse also has a very serious knock-on effect for children. Witnessing abuse can lead to them becoming abusers in the future. Not necessarily, but it can do. But they learn that violence is a normalised way to behave. So it has very serious knock-on effects. It can be very easy to identify human victims, though. And this is actually a famous newsreader in the UK who has been made up to look like she's a victim of domestic abuse. This was actually one of the Women's Aid campaigns that was out a few years ago. But it makes the point that many of the victims, and indeed most of them at some point, will suffer injuries to the head and neck. And facial trauma in a woman is much more likely to be a result of domestic abuse than any other cause. Women don't tend to get into fights in the street as young men may do. And we know that health professionals of any sort will often form long-term relationships with women who come as patients or attached to an animal, for example. And so they're in a very good position to spot changes in either behaviour or in physical appearance. And that will be true of vets as well, because, you know, you tend to go to the same vet all the time. You don't tend to walk around different vet practices to get help for your animals. Tend to go to the same person, and you know, if you're anything like me, I get on very well with my vet, and we have chats about lots of different things while we're there. So this is just some papers to back up the fact that, you know, facial trauma is very common in women who are abused. This is one of our patients, in fact, from Glasgow, who unfortunately was assaulted by her husband. Facial injuries are seen in 50 to 90% of victims, and a paper there by Hutchison found that a facial bruise in a female patient was actually 32 times likely more to be a result of domestic abuse than any other cause. So that's where we got to. Now, when we look at the dentist stuff, and I mention this because this is where the original work came from, that dentists were the group that Barbara Gerbert worked with when she developed this intervention. And what she found was that many of them had suspected patients to be victims of domestic abuse, but they never screened for domestic abuse, even when there were obvious signs of trauma. They only would offer minimal interventions, like maybe writing down something in their notes, but they were too frightened to actually raise the issue with their patients. But what do victims want? Well, actually what they want is to be asked about it. 70% of patients who had been domestically abused presenting to their dentists with signs of abuse wished that they had been asked, and yet 88% were not asked. And it really is, it becomes like that big elephant in the room that everybody knows kind of what's going on, but nobody actually says anything. And that's really a big missed opportunity. And that is, it's typical of what goes on right across healthcare. Happens in doctor surgeries as well. It happens in the vet surgery. It happens with nurses and a whole bunch of other professional groups. So we started training in domestic abuse in 2010 with dentists, because we started with the original programme. We now train vets, doctors, the fire service in Scotland, and we're starting now to train hairdressers and pharmacists, because they are all groups who see women in, you know, those situations, and they are in a good position to intervene. So why vets? Well, animals are often abused as part of a domestic abuse situation, something that our vets in Scotland were quite surprised about, because they didn't believe that anybody could do that to an animal intentionally. 13% of intentional injury to animals involves domestic abuse. And vets are very good at spotting non-accidental injury. What they have more trouble with is believing that it's been done intentionally to harm the human attached to the animal. Threats to animals, though, are often used to prevent a victim from leaving home or to coerce them into doing something. And it's all part of that cycle of coercive control. The really sad thing is, though, that 25 to 40% of victims, and these are statistics from the US, will not leave an abusive situation because they worry about what's going to happen to their pet if they leave. Because for very good reasons, a lot of shelters will not take animals. I guess if you have women in there who are allergic, you can't be taking in cats, dogs, guinea pigs, whatever. So there are very good reasons for shelters not taking in pets, although some, I believe, in the US now do. But it does stop victims from leaving home because they don't want to leave the dog behind or the cat behind. Because they worry that, and in fact often their worries are quite well founded, that the animal will be murdered when they leave. There is a big spectrum also of animal abuse that those of you who are vets will be familiar with, ranging from neglect to emotional abuse, physical abuse, and indeed sexual abuse sometimes as well, and all of these form part of this spectrum that we see in domestic abuse. But vets are becoming more aware of the link. The guidance on the left-hand side there is that we produced in the UK, and we're now issuing with the Animal Welfare Fund and the Lynx Group, who I believe there is a branch of here too. And the guidance on the right is actually new guidance now out from the New Zealand Veterinary Association. That was just issued in the last week. So in terms of recognising human and animal victims in the surgery, it's very similar in terms of looking for repeated injuries, bruises at different stages of healing, fractures at different stages of healing, facial injuries in terms of the animals, maybe cigarette burns, that kind of thing. And these things are all things that we're all taught to look for when we get our child protection training, when we get our domestic abuse training for humans. It's very similar for animals. So the one question we always get asked is, what do you do if you ask somebody if there is abuse occurring and they say yes? Because that's the thing that makes everybody run for the hills. They don't know what to do with the answer to that question. And basically, AVDR gives people a system to use that limits their involvement to just very specific tasks: asking about the abuse, providing a validating message to the victim to make it clear to them that you understand that, one, you believe them, and two, that you understand that it's not their fault and that they don't deserve what's happening to them. And the same obviously is true of the animal. Making some documentation in the notes just in case later on everything goes to court and they ask for you to turn up as a witness. And then referring the owner and the pet on to the appropriate services. And that is where their involvement can finish. And that makes everything a bit more comfortable, because they don't have to get involved in the nitty-gritty of dealing with the abuse, of trying to help somebody leave, etc., etc. There are very specific things in terms of the animal if it has been very seriously abused. There is legislation in Scotland that allows the vet to remove the animal from the owner, and the SSPCA, which is the Scottish Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, would get involved at that stage. One of their inspectors would come take the animal away. So, but you know, they generally speaking, what we need the vets to do is just stop at that point and not get more involved with the dealing with the human side of the abuse, and that makes them more comfortable. So they're not expected to get involved in the nitty-gritty. We know that leaving home for human victims of abuse is the time when they're most at risk, the time when most people experience serious injury or sometimes even death. And so we don't want people to get involved in dealing with that. And it may be that actually for some victims, the safest thing to do is not to leave. And that's something that a lot of people who don't deal with domestic abuse have a lot of trouble understanding. Because if they stay, they have more control over the situation. They know when the perpetrator is coming home. They know what to do to try and keep things calm. And sometimes that is a more stable and manageable situation for them. So everybody is an individual in this situation, and everybody's response to it will be different. So does training help the vets? Well, what we found was that when we trained them, and we've run a few training courses for them, it increased their knowledge, their confidence, and the ability that they had to provide practical assistance to human victims and their animals. The vets were also quite empowered to help victims, and they could see a clear role for themselves in doing this. And actually, several had put this into practice the very day after the training, which was very encouraging, because we got phone calls from them saying, look, I've got this lady in the surgery just now with the dog. The dog's had, you know, it's got three fractures in one leg. It's a Chihuahua. That would be quite unusual. And we were able to talk them through what to do about it. So that was very encouraging. So in terms of recognising abuse before and after, they were more capable, particularly with the human victims, of recognising abuse. They were more able and willing to ask about abuse after the training. They were more confident about what they should write in their notes in terms of going to court, what would make the most sense, what would help the victim the most if they documented it in their notes. They were much, much more aware of how to access help for human victims of domestic abuse, something that they really hadn't been familiar with before, and that, you know, indeed, why should they be? And they were more knowledgeable about their professional and legal responsibilities with regard to the animal victims, because there are very specific legal requirements in terms of animals in Scotland under various different acts. And I think for me, the most important thing was that they were much more committed to helping human and animal victims of domestic abuse, just from having been to the training. And I think even just providing people with a little bit of information about how domestic abuse helps affects people is something that actually empowers more people to help. And they were much more aware of their role. So in summary, the intervention is very quick and easy. It's very simple. Very much limits the inquirer's involvement to simple tasks, devolving them of too much responsibility, which is the thing that always scares people to death. It allows them to work within their comfort zone. And we know with lots of interventions that we might provide in a clinical situation, if your involvement is limited to very specific things, you're much more likely to do it. If you make things too complicated, nobody's going to do anything. And this did seem to increase the confidence of the veterinary professionals in dealing with this subject. The main thing, though, is that we try to play to people's strengths. And the one thing that health professionals of all sorts have in common is that they're very good communicators. They generally have a lot of empathy for people and concern, and the knowledge you can give people. That's an easy thing to give people. You know, we all worry about getting things wrong, but it's better to get it wrong on occasion than not to offer somebody help. So I'd just like to thank all the different groups that were involved in this. That's all their logos up at the top. It's been a big multi-professional effort to get this off the ground, and hopefully we can go on and get more vets in Scotland and maybe a bit further afield trained in doing this. Thank you very much for your attention.
We have time for one question before we move on, but I'm going to try to save some time at the end so we can ask all our speakers that can stay back. Yes, sir.
Are there things that I know that the animal can't say that they
no.
can't do, but if they bring them in and
in the pet. Well, sometimes if the animal is with their abuser, which does sometimes happen, you may notice that they're not very comfortable with them. I mean, I would imagine any kind of dog being taken to the vet is a bit like my dog. They would always rather be with me than the vet. So if you see that kind of difficult interaction between the owner and the animal, then that can be an indication. Sometimes they just look very, they can just look very afraid generally. And sometimes they can be a bit more aggressive, I guess, because, you know, if you hit a dog often enough, sometimes they will bite back at you. So sometimes they can be a wee bit more aggressive. Generally speaking, the physical signs obviously are easier, but vets are very attuned to animals' behaviour and how they interact with their person. And I think a lot they can detect a lot from that. You know, I'm not a vet myself, but this is what I've been told by my colleagues that I work with. So.
Thank you. Okay, I failed to mention introduce myself. I'm Tom Doker, the chair of the Veterinary Public Health Group. I'm a veterinarian, but I'm a public health officer in the Air Force, so that's the link between veterinarian and public health for me. Next, I would like to invite, and she even put this phonetically, but I'm Georgia. We'll see how I do. It's Haley Yaglum. She's a, let's see, let me get the right one here. She has a background in veterinary sciences. She completed her MPH in 2013 at the University of Missouri, with an emphasis in veterinary public health. And she was a project coordinator for the Research Center for that human-animal interaction. And she was, as I said, one of the big instigators of this session this time. She assisted in the implementation of collaborative research on the benefits of the human-animal bond for an array of populations. And most recently, she's moved to the Arizona Department of Health Services as an infectious disease epidemiologist. And I just completed a fellowship of Epidemic Intelligence Service, and she's working with one of my classmates there as a veterinary public health officer. So please welcome Haley.